Welcome to another episode of Systematic Geekology. This is a space where we seek to create and cultivate healthy conversations between those things we geek out on and the philosophical and theological questions that often arise out of our fandoms. Like, what does it mean to be human? What makes a hero? What makes a villain? How do the stories and narratives we geek out on shape how we live in the world? We are your priest to the geeks. We aren't all ordained, but we see ourselves as mediators at the intersection of geek culture and going deeper in our faith. We don't always have to agree, but we do respect each other, and we see everyone as a beloved child of God. Everyone geeks out on something, so come geek out with us and enjoy the show.
You're listening to an Anazal Ministries podcast.
How do you defeat an invincible villain? We're going to be asking that question a lot more on today's episode of Systematic Geekology. We are the Priest of the Geeks. I'm your host, Christian Ashley, here to continue on the series of My Hero Academia. We're very close to the end. We've only got a couple of arcs left, and you know her because she's been with me pretty much the entire time that we've been going through this. Your favorite co-host. That's not me, of course. Elizabeth Pangalang and Clyde. How's it going, Pang?
Hello. It's going pretty well.
All right. So, Pang, what have you been geeking out on recently?
Shockingly, it's not romance at all. It is anime, though. It is anime because we have to. Windbreaker. I binged the first two seasons. Well, there's only two seasons, but I binged, you know, all of season one in like a day because I might have been driving home from Orlando with my nieces and nephews in the car. So I put my noise-canceling headphones in, positioned my phone just right, and I was like, all right, Aunt Liz, we'll see you guys later. And pretty much, you know, listen, binge the whole first season. It was great.
Oh, man. Such an attentive aunt. So caring. So kind. Mm-hmm. That's a good one to binge. The second season wasn't as good for me as opposed to the first one. But, you know, I still like it. It's a good series. Now, me, I years ago bought like the complete works of Edgar Allan Poe, and I have not touched it since I bought it. And now I'm only like 100 pages into an 800 page book. And I'm glad they started with what they did because these are the stinkers at the beginning. And I finally got to the Murders in the Rue Morgue and something good. But yeah, I've read Poe before, but I've never actually read everything he's done. So I'm looking forward to it. There's a reason some of his stories aren't as well known as others. I'll put it that way.
Are you going to go to the Edgar Allan Poe Museum in Richmond, Virginia? You should go.
You know, I've never thought about that. But that does sound like fun.
It was fun. You can see his childhood bed. So a lot of the night terrors that, you know, inspired him to write all of his works. You're not supposed to touch it. I did.
I mean, if we're sharing that, I mean, I got to share a story. I was in high school and my small group leader had a friend who worked in the White House at the time. And we went up to Washington, D.C. as a small group and had a lot of fun, you know, going to Smithsonian and other stuff. When we actually went to the White House proper, she was giving us a tour of stuff, but you couldn't actually go into the Oval Office at that time for some reason. They had it like security lockdown. So what I did is I stood right beside the Oval Office entrance and discreetly stuck my foot inside of it, you know, just because I'm such a rebel. And that way I can actually say I've been inside the Oval Office.
I mean, I see no problem with that.
You know, the biggest security threat to America is definitely me. All right. You didn't come to hear us reminisce about times we broke the rules. You came to actually hear about My Hero Academia. As we continue on through the series, like I said, we are very near the end here. In one of the larger arcs here, there's over 50-some chapters, 20-some episodes devoted to this, the Paranormal Liberation War arc. So, Pang, do you want to help me unpack what happens here? I've got the bulk of it. If you want to chime in whenever, have at it.
I mean, I'm going to just say Ish goes down.
Oh, it goes down.
Big down.
Huge turning point for this series.
Yeah. I mean, it's what it says. It's literally war. And they didn't sugarcoat it at all, which I really appreciate. You feel the devastation of war in this arc, which I appreciate.
Oh, most definitely. So for the sake of time, we're not going to go into every single thing that happens. I'm going to be hitting like bullet points of what goes on. And once again, chime in as you please, Pang, for what goes on here. So we kind of start at the beginning with the kids at the what's happened after last time. They're getting a little better with their powers and stuff. And we go see Eraserhead and President Mike go to prison. They found that Kurogiri is there and that he has actually been a Nomu created from the corpse of their old friend and fellow superhero, Shirakumo, who you don't actually see this in Academia, but you do see this in the manga Vigilantes, which, by the way, has just had its most recent season, well, it's his first season, show up fairly recently, and they've announced a second season coming very soon. So if you want some more of My Hero Academia, that's a good way to go about it, because just a different exploration of the world, a little couple years before the events of My Hero Academia. So they try and talk to him, and there's a brief moment where they kind of like get him to come back to his senses, but it goes back to being Kuragiri again. We then flash over to the Paranormal Liberation Front, who are like getting things ready for the upcoming war. They've got these different teams assigning names to them. And Hawks has been still acting like his double agent. So he's feeding this info to the heroes discreetly, letting them know they're about to attack. So both sides are preparing for war without trying to let the other one know. But the heroes know, and the villains don't know that the heroes know. And at the same time, Shigaraki is being implanted with more power, more quirks from the doctor who has been working with All for One this whole time. And they know, like, we have a better chance of winning, the heroes do, if we attack when Shigaraki is still getting this done. So that's the plan, is to do this and attack before he can come out of this and be stronger than he is before, because he's already pretty strong now that he's taken on All for One and has also taken down Star and Stripe. So we go over to All Might and see that he's researching like the old users of One for All. And he's telling Deku and Bakugo about this. And he says that the Black Whip that Deku used was the quirk of the fifth user, Banjo. Great name. And that his mentor, Nana Shimura, actually had a quirk too, and her quirk was float. So one of the things they're going to do is actually train some of Deku's quirks a little more. He'll unlock more along the way. As we're in, you know, Hawks tells everyone what's going to happen, so the heroes start forming their teams to get ready for this attack. We've got one that's going to the hospital where Shigaraki is like having the experiments done to him. We've got another one that's going to like try and take the hugest part of the army away and like imprison them. Then we've got some of the UA students just kind of being backup for that team just in case anything goes wrong. And another group is going to be evacuating civilians. So right before the battle actually starts, Hawks confronts twice and tells him, look, I'm a double agent. I got to kill you first, because, well, he's trying to apprehend him first, but because he doesn't want him to die, because he actually does kind of like him, but he betrays him and they go through a process where Twice ends up actually dying, but not before he sends a clone away and sends multiple clones of himself away to be a huge threat to the heroes. And that's why Hawks wanted them out, because if he just keeps copying himself, he could be an army to himself. So you get to the one army that goes to take down Shigaraki. They confront the doctor, find out that he has a quirk too, and it's allowed him to stay alive for as long as he has. And he actually gave that quirk to All for One, which explains why he's been alive for as long as he has. And then he recreated the quirk so he could stay alive. And through that process, they learn, oh no, we actually aren't as early as we thought we were. Shigaraki's almost done. He comes out of what's been enhancing him and he kills some of the heroes around him, activating his decay. Anything you want to add before we head forward?
No, because we'll talk about like the favorite characters and introductions and along the way.
So now that he's out, Shigaraki wants to track down One for All, because that's the one thing missing. Like, just to make All for One's plans and his plans go through, he needs to take All for One away. Deku kind of realizes this and through the process uses himself as bait to try and make sure that other people aren't attacked as much, because with that decay, he can pretty much kill anyone. So Eraserhead is also having to be there to stop him from using some of his quirks. He can't stop all of them, the ones like the physically enhancing ones, but he can stop the ones like decay. And through this, Shigaraki has also ordered Gigantomachia to appear on scene now that they're buddy-buddy. And he starts attacking some of the heroes. Mount Lady tries to fight him, and Momo and some of the other kids are fighting against him, trying to sedate him and put him out of the fight. And through this process, Gran Torino ends up injured, should have died, but kind of emboldening Deku and Bakugo a little more to fight through this. And Todoroki comes in to help him out. As we get through some further things where Deku kind of reveals that he's learned to master Float as well as the Black Whip and a couple of other ones. We'll see a cute little flashback where he's helped out Biochako. Very sweet romantic moment between them before they're actually anything. Then we find that, oh gosh, where is it at? What is Bakugo has been saving his hero name this whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone else thinks that Best Genius is dead. He's wanted to save it and let Best Genius know. So Best Genius shows up on the scene. Mirio shows up on the scene too. He's been given his quirk back thanks to Eri, who the more her horn grows, the more she can like restore things. And now at the cost of her horn, she until it regrows, she's able to give him his quirk back. But in the middle of this fight, Bakugo reveals his hero name finally, and it's I think it's Great Explosion Murder God Dynamite.
Mm-hmm. I love it. It's fantastic. 10 out of 10.
Oh, that's perfect. It's something that a kid would think is cool. And even someone as high strung as him, like, of course he thinks this is cool. And of course he'd never say this because forever ago when they said, here, we had to make good hero names for everyone, this would have been a turn down immediately. But it's too late now. He's announced it to the world. And then as Endeavor and some of the other heroes are fighting, Dobby ends up showing up on the scene. And we finally get the big reveal about who he is. He is not just Dobby. He is Toya Todoroki, the Todoroki that everyone else thought was killed, or excuse me, not killed, died while Endeavor was training him, being too harsh for his own good. And he's letting the entire world know what a scum of a father he has. And starting to try and break down the people's belief in the heroes. Gigantomachia is able to get free, but he's able to get knocked out by Endeavor in the midst of this. We learn that Mr. Compress is actually, I think it's great-great-grandson of an old villain back in the day, and that he kind of sacrifices himself, not like dying, to get people to safety for a little bit there. And Deku and Shigaraki are still fighting each other, but it gets to the point where All for One kind of takes control from Shigaraki. And then as everyone's kind of beaten down from the fight, they flee. Shigaraki, now controlled by All for One, goes to a prison, breaks out a bunch of people also to get his original body back. So there's an All for One in control of his body and an All for One in control of Shigaraki's body. Oh, wait. Did I skip ahead? We haven't gotten... Star and Stripe was before or after this?
I think it was like alluded, like near the, like almost like she's coming, but she hasn't came yet. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I'm confusing myself.
She doesn't show up until later. Yeah.
That's next. So sorry, spoilers for what, for what happens next. Yeah. My bad. I was getting all over the place there. So comes a point where the heroes have lost but also won, the villains have lost but also won, and now there's this uncertainty about what's going on. Deku meets in while he's in the hospital the other members of One for All, and they basically tell him, look, your powers are gonna die if you give it to someone else who doesn't have a quirk, and the chances of that happening are very slim to none because it kind of fights against other quirks in the body if that person already possesses one. So the fact that All Might had it and got it to his full potential is why he was able to do that, because he was quirkless. Same way with Deku. He's getting to that point. So it's kind of the make it or break it. You're the last guy. You better defeat Shigaraki All for One. Otherwise, it's not going to happen. And that's where we kind of end here, as Deku has decided that he can't stay with his friends anymore. He's a target. All for One, Shigaraki can always find him because of the search quirk that he has that he stole from Ragdoll. So he goes off to become his own vigilante hero. And that's where this arc ends. So, Pang. And I'm done with all that. Do you have a favorite character in this arc?
I mean, I want to say Hawks, but I feel like I can't say Hawks. So I'm not going to say Hawks, even though we all know it's Hawks. Make sense?
Yes, yes.
Okay, good. So I feel like I was trying to think of a character you wouldn't expect me to pick.
Okay.
So I'm going to say Mirko. Because she literally gave an arm.
And a leg.
And I, yeah. She wasn't really my favorite because, I mean, if you guys don't know, she's the tan bunny girl quirk type deal. And I just didn't love the macho-ness, you know, she portrayed. I don't know. Like, I'm a girl's girl, I guess. And so I'm like, you know, that's great for you. But she just never stuck out to me. But she kicked booty facing five no moves by herself. So that was impressive. And I mean, when she couldn't prolong, you know, a stop. Why can I think of it? Well, she couldn't stop him, but she still kind of went for him, even like literally losing limbs. So I feel like she needs to be the favorite character of this arc because she, I would say, I mean, gave up the most that was not her life. Because obviously some people gave up their life. So,
yeah. And we do have some people dying here. We have lesser heroes like X-List. Then we have one of the top 10 in Crust who we haven't actually like met a lot. So his death doesn't really do anything for me.
Yeah. No one major that we know besides twice.
Midnight. Who else? In this arc.
I forgot about that.
It's not really focused on too much as in like showing the death and like it's shown the reactions of the students, but yeah, she does die in this arc.
They made it seem like more like, I was like, oh, is she unconscious? But then you're like, oh wait, no, she's dead.
Yeah. For me, going through this, like plenty of people get some really good moments here. Like Tokuyami gets some nice moments, like trying to fight some villains. Momo has a great plan in trying to sedate Gigantomachia. And it's not really her fault that the dosage is kind of wrong. It's kind of a plan that had to be made up on the fly and she did really well. Let's see who else. Of course, Mirio, my boy, my number one, shows back up with his powers as a threat. Hey-oh. As someone to be taken seriously, which couldn't have been done without Eri. And some people would accuse her of being like a prop or just a plot convenience. But no, it's established. There's a cost to her doing what she does. Like she can't just do it every day. She had to build up her power to the point where she could bring Mirio a quirk back, which is great. Eraserhead, Aizawa, brings a great moment here where when he actually gets hit. Yeah, he gets hit with a quirk erasing bullet. And before it can spread to the rest of his body, and which would mean that he'd not be able to shut off Shigaraki's powers, he cuts off his goddamn leg. Now, that's a man right there. That's a hero. And he did his job well. But, I mean, honestly, I might have to give it to Deku here.
Oh, yeah, when he used his tongue to fight.
I mean, like, how he adapts his abilities, like, learning from how his other classmates have done stuff. Like, he calls it, like, Froppy style, using Black Whip in that manner. Because it shows, like, he's been studying them, like he's been doing since the first chapter we've seen him, studying other heroes, how they do stuff, and jotting it down for future reference. And now, oh, if I use my power like this, I can do that. And then him realizing, oh, Shigaraki's after me. I can't explain that to everyone on the air, but I just need you to trust me. And the fact that Endeavor does trust him when that scene comes up is pretty relevant, is pretty well done. And of course, the confrontation he has with Shigaraki is pretty, it's a great fun fight. So I'm actually going to give it to Deku. And like, even his choice at the end is kind of, it's a kind of, not really controversial choice, but it's one where it kind of went, I don't know about that, buddy. But it makes sense. It's like, oh, he can find me wherever I go. So let me not endanger everyone else. Let me just endanger myself, which is a reckless move, but he's also a teenager. So I'm fine with that.
All right. Yeah. I mean, Deku seemed obvious, but like Hawks, but I'll give it to you.
And Hawks, we can't, I mean, like we have to discuss that too. He does his job well in this arc. All that double talk and I'm on your side, right guys? But I'm actually on this side.
Poor Twice.
And then, I know, like the betrayal that Twice feels, it's real because he thought that they were friends. And like Hawks does want to be friendly to him, like, but he also wants him to be reformed. He doesn't want him to be a villain. He wants him to get proper, you know, treatment for what's going on. But it's a really bad time to reveal all this to the man. So the fight was inevitable. I don't know what else you thought would happen. And it does get to the point where he actually does have to kill Twice. And you can tell his immense regret because that's not what he wants to happen, but he knows for the greater good it has to be done.
Mm-hmm. It's just, well, it was a sad time. Yeah. I always, whenever you feel sympathy for the villain, you know it's well written. Because normally you cheer when they die or you cheer when they're defeated. But like in that scene, like you felt so much empathy and you felt sadness. And even for, Toga, knowing that she's going to be affected, like it was just really played out on both sides. But I mean, Hawk had to do what he had to do, that double agent.
Do you have a favorite scene or moment from this arc?
I mean, probably I would say the Twice versus Hawks, because I mean, you couldn't help but, if you were on your phone while watching it, you would have put it down or, you know, full focus on it. And then it's just, I mean, and especially because after, we already know Twice's backstory now and his mental, like, stability and all that stuff. And I'm like, oh, it's like, Hawks, you kind of suck.
Well, we also get some of Hawks's backstory here, too.
Oh, yeah, how he was the prodigy and, like, he had to, like, pretty much meet a standard his whole life. And so that's always hard, too. Like, you think people who are naturally gifted have it easy, but then that, like, added pressure of them having to perform and not really getting to do what they want to do, that makes a psychological toll on you as well.
We also find out that he's basically the son of criminals, and that's a huge part of his psyche. Didn't they sell him off, too? I think that's what it was.
Yeah.
I can't remember off the top of my head, but one of his small comforts during that time was a doll of Endeavor. And that is a huge reason why he looks up to Endeavor now, even knowing what the man is like, even knowing what he's done to his family. Like, there's still that part of him, you were my hero, and you're why I do what I do, because you gave me hope, because you made me want to be better. And yeah, I was trained to be this hero who's always backstabbing people and doing stuff like that, but I do it to make people have easier lives. Now me, man, it's a rough one, because, I mean, there's a lot of really good moments here. Yeah, it's some very... some good suspense in the fight in the hospital. It's like, when is Shigaraki going to come out? Are they going to be able to get there in time? That's a fun one. But really, I'm just going to say the free-for-all fight against Shigaraki. As he's gaining new abilities, learning how to use this new body better. You know, Deku showing off some of his new skills that he learned from the quirks that have activated from the previous users of One for All. I always do that. It's so easy to flip the two. One for all for one. Deku is one for all. And then, of course, Bakugo kind of doesn't sacrifice himself, but he, as in dying, but he takes a hit for Deku in the midst of all that, proclaims himself to be Great Explosion, Murder God Dynamite, great moment for him. And then, of course, Mirio joining into the fight, Aizawa acting as he does to, like, make sure that they can survive, because if he goes down, they're all dead. Like, the sheer willpower to not only cut off your leg, but then to remain standing and looking at this guy because his power requires eyesight. Chef's kiss. Like, they did a tremendously great job with that. And I guess that ties into fights. We both talked about fights. I mean, is there anything better than the fights we've mentioned?
No. I mean, yeah, the Miracle versus Onomu, Twice versus Hawks, and then Deku's fight. Those are the top three of this arc.
Yeah. This is a very fight-heavy arc. And there's a reason for that. Yeah, you're in the middle of a war. If there wasn't a lot of fights here, I don't really know what I'd be dealing with here. It's kind of hard to call it a war arc, but then, like, we just talk and have our feelings out. Like, it's not that kind of show, not that kind of manga. So beyond that, as we get to the final part here of our little introduction, like, what do you think? Quirks introduced in this arc. Do you have a favorite?
Let's see. I know the washing machine quirk got, like, a little bit of highlights with the floating people to safety. So that was kind of nice, because you're like, what the heck is this person useful for? And you're like, oh, that heck is what this person's useful is for.
So we're introduced to Nana's quirk.
The decay, his decay 2.0 was introduced.
Yeah, he had the decay, but he extrapolated on that, made it a little bigger this time.
Yeah.
Then we've got the shield quirk that Crust uses to manifest, like, the rocky kind of shields. Then let's see what else. There's the Exilus laser quirk, which is basically just Cyclops, way dumber Cyclops in this series. He totally deserves his death. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, I don't think, like, any of those really stuck out to me. So I'm gonna just, even though we already kind of knew about the washing machine quirk, we actually got to see it in action. So I'm going to go the washing machine, whatever the hero name is.
Okay. Then there's the doctor's quirk, and I'll get to my actual answer after this one. The one where it's revealed that he can pretty much, like, double his life by sacrificing the fact that he's not as agile or something like that anymore. So he can live two times longer than anyone else. That's cool. Not my favorite by any stretch of the imagination. My actual favorite is the danger sense quirk that Deku kind of activates in the middle of the fight from a previous user of One For All. And you know me, big Spider-Man guy, spider sense, it just makes sense. And Horikoshi is a huge Spider-Man nerd. He's also a huge Star Wars nerd. And danger sense is also an ability there. I think it shows up first in one of the Anderson novels. I want to say it's like Champions of the Force or something like that, or Children of the Force. I can't remember off the top of my head. But yeah, it's a super useful one. It's like, oh, if someone's about to attack me, I need to get out the way, or something's going to go wrong. What's going on? Well, let me check my surroundings again. As someone, I'm not clumsy by nature, but it'd be nice to have this for when those moments do come up and go, oh, wait, what was I about to do? Or where was I about to go where something would have like tripped me or caused harm to me?
I don't pay attention to the new quirks, like, because I like my oldies. It's like when a new kid comes, I don't like to accept them as much.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Unless they like, you know, show up in a big way. And I feel like to me, they didn't show up in a big way.
Let's get into the content.
Let's do it.
And as addressed earlier on, All Might does his work, does his research, and into the previous wielders of One For All, and finds out some of their quirks, how they died. He doesn't know everything. Like, specifically, it mentions, I think, the third and fourth, or maybe the second and third, that he knows nothing about. But, like, how is this portrayed when it shows up? And what were our expectations before this?
I was kind of shocked that, because I guess he was number one and he didn't have... Like, he had a foe, but, like, he was better than his foe. So I'm like, why didn't you do this before dire, like, circumstances, right? Like, why didn't you think about, like, you know, exploring all that one awful one had to offer? But I'm like, it's fine, I guess. But doing it now, better late than dead, right? But that was kind of, like, my thing. I was like, why didn't you already know this? What do you mean you don't have all the information already? Like, Gran Torino doesn't know? Like,
well, that's part of it. Is that he had to go and do his research because no one really knows. Because if you remember when All For One was like top dog back in the day, they were at war during the entire time. So the records aren't kept as well. They don't know. There were plenty of heroes, but not everyone had their own academy or internships and stuff like that. So they were just fighting to survive. So no one was writing down, hey, Banjo had his black whip quirk, and that's why he does what he does, or this guy had his danger sense.
They really needed a Deku during that time.
Yeah, because it was extremely fractious time period where they were just trying to live, trying to bring stability to the world that just barely was able to stop All For One. By the time of, I think, Nana is when she doesn't take him out, but she's fierce enough against him to make him lesser of a villain. And then when All Might, of course, shows up, that's when he takes them out of the fight for a little bit. So now they're finally to the point where they can live and reconstruct some things. So that's the reason why it didn't happen. And I didn't think about that until this arc when I said, oh, that makes sense. Why wouldn't he know about the people who came before him? You mean they weren't talking? Well, as we'll learn in this arc and then later on, some of them literally died, found the next person right next to him and said, look, I've got like 5 seconds to explain this, take this quirk, and then give it to someone else later on. And that's just how it worked.
Poor planning, if you ask me, but whatever. It is fun to know, like, whenever we do learn more of the quirks, that not all of them are, you know, it wasn't like all of the past people were the number one heroes, right? So yeah. Some of them were just average heroes, or some of them didn't even have like a quirk, like an original quirk that was super useful in fighting. So that was kind of nice seeing how it, I guess, was so diverse in the past.
Yeah. And it's great that Horikoshi does this. He doesn't like, he's not trying to make Deku like the strongest hero in the world. He's just trying to like, give him something that can help him. Like, you think of someone like Spider-Man, you know, it's good. He's got super strength. He can web swing across the city, but the original one until later on and then I got retconned, he doesn't actually produce the webs. He actually had to like make them up himself. The danger sense is great, but if I don't have the agility and reflexes to get out of the way of trouble, it's not going to do me much good. So for someone like Deku, who is already very agile, already very strong, the danger sense makes perfect sense for him to have something like that. The float is great too. That means he can suspend himself. The black whip is good too, because that means he has ways of traversing around the battlefield he wouldn't have. So like, yeah, it's done in a way like, yeah, he gets other quirks, but he's not like the best of the best. He has to actually train in them too.
Mm-hmm.
So as mentioned earlier, we finally get the reveal of Dobby's true identity, something people had been speculating about since he showed up on the scene, since he seemed to have kind of a grudge against Endeavor. Turns out he's actually his son, Toya, who Endeavor thought died in the middle of a training accident and when he was pushing him far too much. And so, Payne, how does this play out in the story and what are our thoughts on the reveal?
I'm going to just say, because as someone who didn't read the manga and I didn't have any spoilers and I'm not a speculator, I had no idea. I was completely blindsided. I was like, what? Wow, mind blown. So that was kind of nice.
Yeah.
I didn't think it was obvious or like anything like that. I was like, oh yeah, he hates superheroes. Got it. So the reveal was crazy and he did it in the most public way possible. Yes. He really, was out to destroy his dad's facade, which I get it. I mean, seeing the abuse and everyone love, like experience the abuse and then everyone loving him on the surface, like that's crazy when you know he is the worst. I very, very, very loosely, I see it a little bit in like the church world because I married the very talented, very anointed worship pastor who has the voice of an angel. And when people see him on stage, they're like, he's so anointed, like the God is using him. And, you know, they just have all the praises for my husband, which is fantastic. But I'm like, you guys didn't see him literally. We just came from a doctor's office. He got frustrated and mouthed off at the secretary. The receptionist. Granted,
yes.
He apologized before we left. So he did because we're all allowed to be human, right? And we're all allowed to come short. He apologized for his frustration because we just were not getting like answers that we wanted. But the point is like, I see that side, a side of my husband that the world will never see. And so Dobby was like, no, you guys will see what we've seen and exposed them. So I'm kind of like, dang. I get it.
Of course. Yeah. What Endeavor did was way worse than simply like getting angry at someone at their job. Like he literally abused his family.
Yes.
Caused harm to them.
It's just crazy. Like the public unmasking. And I mean, whether obviously like he did what he did and he is trying, like at this point, we've talked about it before. He's trying to do atonement and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes your atonement has to be public. Yes. So this is a part of his atonement journey. Go at it. Like I didn't really feel like sympathy for him, but I'm kind of like, you did do this. Just like these pastors who have fallen short and they have to go before the public and do a public apology. And like, this is a part of your atonement.
That makes perfect sense to me. It's like, look, yeah, sometimes you may be able to keep something hidden. Other times, it's just better for it to be brought into the light, especially if you're in a position of authority like that. Say, look, here's what I did. Here's how I screwed up. Especially if you're counseling someone who's struggling with that thing and you're going to act like you never went through it. Like, if they ever learn about that, you've broken trust immensely. I'm not saying you have to tell them every little detail about what's going on, but as someone who has counseled people in the past who have done things that I've done, I have admitted freely, like, look, I've struggled with this. Here's what I did. Here's what someone else told me, because I want to make sure they know the truth. Yeah, it may lower their opinion of me. You know, that's fine. As long as it means that the truth is out there and they are hopefully getting better. And it's also healing for you to admit it too. And when it comes to this, like, I'm not going to pretend like I knew it was Dobby was Toya from the beginning. I had to actually see someone write it on... I think it was on Reddit. It's like, I think that Dobby is Toya, and here's why. And it listed the reasons. Like, okay, that makes sense. And then rereading the chapters, go, okay, I see that. I see that. I think the same thing. I'm going to adopt this hypothesis for myself. And it turned out to be true. So I can't claim credit for that. But yeah, it Yeah, it was a fun reveal because I was kind of expecting it. And I'm not one of those people who hates being spoiled about something or feels that if I figure something out, that automatically makes it bad. It depends on how you deliver it. And this was delivered fairly well in a way that has lasting repercussions for the My Hero Academia world because it's a huge public event and there's no way to get ahead of it. There's no way to spin it any other way. Everyone knows you're an abuser. You thought your son was dead. You thought that you killed him by accident. And he's still alive. He's a villain. And now the world is having to deal with your villain son because you were a terrible person and a terrible father. No wonder the public starts losing faith in the heroes at the end of this arc.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Especially because they're already kind of like, what are they doing? And they've been put in danger before. And so this really did kind of crack that facade to a lot of people of like, well, if Endeavor is doing this, what are the other ones doing too?
Right. And it's the same thing you mentioned, pastors and stuff. Like, well, if this pastor, slept with the secretary or embezzled this money.
All of the pastors are doing it.
I mean, surely the rest are hiding something. And yeah, we're all human beings. Yeah, we're all screwed up. But you create that perception that if you had just either A, avoided the sin, or B, acknowledged it before it came out, things wouldn't be as bad in people's perception of that position that you've now tainted with what you did. So next up, this whole arc has been an accusation thrown against by some people about this arc. Essentially that it's a fight between government mandated forces who are maintaining the status quo versus a group of political dissidents and reformers. Do you agree or disagree with this take?
Yeah, I would agree with that because like the villains, they claim to be exposing a broken system built on the privilege. So like the pretty heroes, they get more recognition or more perks, or the one with the cool quirks or the one more, respected. And so I get like there is a broken system. We've already talked about that and agreed, but their liberation is just a little twisted. You know what I mean? They're not really vigilantes where they're doing it for the overall good and trying to bring justice. They're just doing destruction and like doing it out of like, you suck and we're going to get you.
Yeah. There's more of a pettiness behind it. It's not, and that's what the words they use, but the actual leaders don't care that much. Not to say they don't care at all, because I think Shigaraki does actually like his friends, and he does want to see mm-hmm. someone like Spinner respected more, even though Spinner as a reptilian person looks very different than regular humans. So I think there's something there, but it's used for their gain rather than actually being the heart and soul of why they do what they do. And yeah, there are certain parts, like we've discussed before, that need to change about the current hero system that, favors some over others, that allows discrimination to take place, even with just the quirkless, as opposed to people who are still majority with quirks. Yeah, something needs to be done there, but this is not the way to go about it, because at the end of the day, you're just trying to make things in your image versus one that actually benefits as many people as possible.
Yeah, I mean, if they were more about reform and not destruction or ruin, then I would probably gone with no, I disagree, they're being good peeps, but nah, they just got a bunch of feelings hurt and they want their way and they're mad they're not getting their way.
Yeah. And one of those people affected by that is Twice. And as we mentioned, he dies mm-hmm. in this fight. So beyond what I've said, how does this happen? How does this affect the story?
This affects the story a lot because as we will know in the next arc or in two arcs from now, there's pretty much a lot of rejects, there is in the system. And so just kind of like how I was talking to Taylor yesterday when we had our team meeting, I'm like, do you know we have 20,000 listeners? I mean, there's a lot of nerds out there. And when you have a common goal, you can be powerful. So all of these rejects have a common goal and they're being and they can be powerful. And so now they're coming together. And so they're getting momentum. And even after this war, got even more momentum, especially with the public losing faith in the heroes. So this changes everything pretty much. It's not going to be the same.
Yeah. And for Twice, he suffered immensely from mental illness as a result of not only his biochemistry, but from his quirk. And he finally found a group of people who accepted him and loved him and were friends with him. And then he's betrayed by one of those people who likes him and wants to see him well, but cannot abide what Twice and his friends are planning. We have in Hawks. And so that betrayal kind of cuts him even deeper, and it affects how Hawks is going to look at the villains from here on out. there's always that question of what could I have done to save twice? Because I had to kill him. There was really no other way to go about that, because things would have been 1,000 times worse if he unleashed all those clones at once. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, Toga is hugely hit by this, because she was really the closest one to him outside of Hawks. And we start learning things about her quirk and how she's able to adapt things and how that will affect things later on, given her relationship with him and how her quirk has to work in order for that to be successful. So she's going to carry that with her for the rest of this series. And that's going to, of course, affect her like rivalry, pseudo friendship with Uraraka based off of this, because she's going to go, well, you want this world, but your world rejected my friend twice. So what's going on here?
Mm-hmm. Even to the point of your world killed my friend twice, which holds even more weight.
Yes. All right.
Oh, Toga.
So, complicated character. Mm-hmm. So a big factor, and huge part of this arc, is that the villains kind of win. Even though you could argue they lost the battle, they kind of won, not the war, but a huge propaganda boost for them. As we see some heroes retiring at the end, thinking they're not good enough anymore, the public turning their backs on them, Deku being separated from his classmates and his mentors. Like, how do we take this as it happened? And what does it mean for the series' future?
Yeah, so, I mean, as we said, like, they may not have won the war as in, like, they defeated the heroes, but as we mentioned before, they won because not only did they take out, they definitely crippled the hero forces. So they may not have, like, won this specific war, but they definitely, you know, won the battle of, we crippled them, they are experiencing hurt and loss, and because they're righteous, they feel it more. But as we mentioned, the public now has even less faith in the heroes. And this is going to turn the world upside down. They don't know who to trust or who's in the right. And so now they don't have the public support.
Yeah. And there's an image used here that's very telling. It's graffiti on an All Might statue that says, "I am not here." And mm-hmm. I mean, that's been from the very beginning. Like, "I am here" is supposed to be a rallying cry. It's supposed to give people comfort and know that the heroes are out there watching them and, you know, protecting them, looking out for them. And now the public doesn't feel that way anymore. And it's going to cause huge, fractious arguments and disturbances throughout the series, because the villains kind of own parts of Japan now. And yeah, we were able to get some of the army and imprison them, but all for one, Shigaraki also broke the original All for One out of prison and a lot of prisoners, including some who are going to show up in later arcs. So that's going to kill your belief in the system when it's destroyed like that in front of you. So no wonder people are lashing out. No wonder they're going to have issues with the heroes, because they're not the ones. I mean, they're not supposed to be using their quirks, these regular people, by law. So what does that mean for them? Are they able to use them now? Or do they have to listen to authority? Or does that mean they're just going to join the other side? And have those questions to ask that didn't exist when the heroes were actually 100% doing their jobs well.
Yeah. I mean, and I've said it before in other podcasts, like, I'm always going to side on the side of law and order. But at this point, the question of what is law and what is order, because now the line is completely blurred. And so now, as we're going to see, society is going to fall into chaos and, I wouldn't say despair, really. Some people would be despair, but it's just going to be like chaos and unknown.
Yeah. I mean, it's very anarchic in certain parts of Japan after this, because they don't know who to trust anymore. Like, there used to be something they could trust in, and now it's taken away from them. So how are they supposed to live? And it's going to be not a huge part, but it's going to be a part of what is a motivating factor for certain people as the series continues. And I think it's done really well here, because you want your heroes to win. But even though, I mean, they achieved some of their objectives, they didn't get everything. So there's still hope that things will get better, but it's not as hopeful as it was before this arc happened. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Pang, you have anything else you'd like to add before we start wrapping things up?
We would like to say rest in peace twice and midnight.
All right. So guys, we're going to have a special bonus question today for our Patreon Captivate supporters. And that question is going to be, who would we have had die in this arc to raise the stakes more? Because some of these jokers should have died. I'm just putting it that way. but we'll get there when we get there. So out of 10, Peng, what are you rating this particular arc?
I'm going to say an 8.
Okay. I'm going to throw a 9. I think this is really well done. You got some good fights here, some good reveals that happen, great character motivations for based off of those reveals and prior revelations. It's just really well done. It's very fun. It's not the best of the best, but it's good.
I agree.
All right. So do you have a recommendation for the audience?
Go to Disney. I just got back from Disney, but I went with kids, and that was the worst. So go to Disney by yourself or with a close friend. No kids. That's my recommendation to you.
Okay. So pretty soon, I'm going to be on an episode that normally would just have been a comic book catch-up, but we're actually, I think, going to make it a full episode going over the career and comics of Peter David, who recently passed. And in doing that, I've reread some of his old Spectacular Spider-Man, and gosh, it's good. Like the Sin Eater storyline alone, Spider-Man and Daredevil's friendship becoming even better with the reveal of their secret identities. Oh, greatly done. We've lost a real titan of the comics industry. And we're going to have more to say when the episode releases. Maybe it releases before this, maybe after, I don't know. But look on that in the horizon. So, guys, thank you for all that you do. Please, if you get a chance, leave a 5-star review on your podcasting platform of choice. Help us with the ratings there to help find us more people that would be interested in the show. We just said numbers earlier. That number was not the number when I first got here. And it's because of people like you sharing the show with other people, suggesting ideas to us, joining and discussions that we have on Facebook and more. Like, thank you for all that. I really appreciate it. As well, if you have any questions or episode topic ideas you want to send our way, shoot us an email at systematicgeekology@gmail.com. I'd like to shout out some supporters. Thank you to Aaron Hardy, Daniel Sigmund, Trip Fuller, and James Barrett. You guys are the best. But remember, we're all the chosen people. A geekdom of priests.
Hey, podcast fam. Want to stay even more connected with the show? We've got you covered. Check us out on Instagram and Blue Sky, where we're posting exclusive content and bonus videos and fun updates that you won't get anywhere else. From sneak previews of upcoming episodes to bonus content, our social accounts are the best way to keep the conversation going. Plus, it's a great spot for you to interact with other listeners and share your thoughts. We love hearing from you. When you follow us, it helps us grow and continue bringing you the content that you love. Whether it's a funny poll, a quick clip from today's episodes, or just random thoughts, you'll feel more plugged into everything we're doing. So go ahead and hit that follow button on Instagram and Blue Sky. It's one more way to be a part of the show and keep the good vibes flowing. Thanks for being a part of the family, and we can't wait to see you there.
Hi, friends. It's Laura here, and I just wanted to say thank you for listening to our show. Systematic Geekology is a part of a larger podcast network called the Anazal Podcast Network. Dummy for Theology is Joshua Noel's show discussing different theological topics from various perspectives and attempting to give people more questions than answers. My Seminary Life is Brandon Knight's show. It started as him going through what he was learning in seminary, and after he graduated, he's been doing independent studies and has a lot of fun series like on hermeneutics, Bonhoeffer Summer, and worship. And then Friday Night Frights is a monthly show with Christian Ashley and Joe Day. They have a vote on the Systematic Geekology Facebook group to choose a topic each month and discuss everything from cryptos to ghosts to aliens to serial killers and more. So we hope you'll give it a listen, and thanks for being part of what we're putting out there.